And welcome to another episode of the Women's and Girls Coach Development Podcast. Today we're joined by Martin Evans, Lydia Bedford and Kelsey Byrne.
Hi everyone, I'm Martin Evans. I'm Women's Lead Physical Performance Coach. So my role is to oversee the physical performance for all the pathway teams on the women's side. At present I've been delivering to the under-19s, previously supported women's under-20s and women's under-21s.
Brilliant, Lydia.
Hiya, I'm Lydia. I currently work in the YD phase as under-16s head coach. Basically, on a two-year cycle for the last 3 years, I've worked in a similar phase and taken a group of players through from 15s to 17s. So yeah, that's the experience.
Brilliant. And Kelsey?
Hi guys, Kelsey, obviously a colleague of Mark's. My region is the Northwest and West Midlands, so I'll work with some clubs on the call. And today I'm obviously going to be working alongside Mark to quiz and unpick both the experience of Martin and Lydia to bring this stuff to life and hopefully get some questions answered for the guys on the call.
Brilliant. And Kelsey, I see you've already started the record button. Just for those of you that are on the call, just to let you know, we are recording it because there are obviously a number of staff that can't make this evening because they're training or unavailable. So we will be sharing tonight's conversation with those people on a direct basis. Brilliant. Right. That's enough of me. I'm just going to share my screen again just so that we can see the questions that we're going to start with, and then it's over to you two. So give us a little bit more around just this identity of the difference between match pace training and peak game and the questions that are on the board now.
So from our perspective, so from a physical performance perspective, these two terms were used quite interchangeably previously. So what we decided to do, and Lydia's do, is kind of split them out a bit more. So when we talk about peak game pace training, we're referring to the kind of peak demands that we see within match play, which is kind of what in the webinar we were talking about, in that hardest 1 minute, the hardest 2 minute, what's the meters per minute that players covers, how many accelerations, decelerations the players cover in that moment in time. Whereas I think Lydia's going to talk about maybe what match pace or match intensity works from a coaching perspective.
Yeah, so one of the questions that came through was around like why you wouldn't want to train at match pace intensity all the time, which I think it's just the interpretation of what Martin's describing in terms of the peak game pace. I think as coaches, we probably all use the phrase like train how you play. And what we're not saying is that we don't want all of training sessions to be kind of completed of a good intensity, and we want the players to be able to feel the intensity they would in a game. But the peak game pace training is about the hardest moment in the game, and you could never train at that level of intensity throughout a duration of a full session. So that's where they're slightly different. And what we're, I guess, trying to encourage is that we get more elements of training out that have that hardest moment within them.
Brilliant. Kelsey, is there anything you want to add to that, or do you want to move on to the second question?
Yeah, I think it was just a clarifying message really around making sure that everyone was really comfortable with what that means, because I think having a coach's hat on, we want players to get into good habits, we want them to train at a good intensity, we want them to train how they play. So there could be a little bit of confusion around why would we not do this all the time. So I think it was just being really clear around, you know, what a really good training habit is and a really good training intensity, but also what peak game pace actually is and how we hit that as well. Because what we don't want you to do is think that peak game pace needs to happen all the time. And on the flip side of that, thinking that actually we can just train mediocre as long as we hit peak game pace. So I think it was just a little bit of clarity around that really for everybody on the call. And obviously we'll take further questions on that if anyone is still a little bit unsure between the two. But I think moving on to the second question around the physical targets and whether they were player or position specific, I think it was a good question around, was it a team average that we were focusing the peak game pace on, or was it player and position specific? And Martin, if you know, you've got some things to share and some slides to share around that. So do you just want to take people through the answer to that question and whether it is position specific itself or whether it's it's quite a team-orientated output.
Yeah, I will just share my screen so that you can see what I'm talking about. Have you got that, Lids, Kels?
Yeah. Yeah, perfect.
So this is taken from the analysis, and this is the extensive side of the peak game pace. And what we can kind of see is when we split it down by position, there isn't actually a great deal of a difference between, in this case, the meters covered per minute by position. So what we're saying is that everybody needs to be prepared to cope with this demand. And I guess what probably differs between positions is when they experience it. And going back to the first webinar that we presented on, it's kind of putting this alongside game state to see where this happens for a central defender versus a forward, because it's likely that those happen in very different game states. Having just come off a camp where we experimented with a 3-4-3, I think compared to a normal back four, the back three would experience those greater demands than normal in different times, because the two wider centre backs are being exposed differently to how they would normally play in a back four. Does that make sense, guys?
Yeah, perfect. And I think it's probably a relief for some on the call that there's not loads of individualisation onto this. There's not loads of different things to think about in terms of different positions and how I incorporate different positions and how that looks differently. It's just about trying to find that peak game pace and ensuring that everyone is prepared for that, which I'm pretty sure is a good thing for most on the call, that there's not another layer of individualisation to think about. Anything to add on to that, Lids?
The only thing that sprung to mind really was, sometimes we're blessed with live GPS on camp, so you can actually see if some players are, you know, not hitting the level or if they are. But I think naturally as a coach, as you're watching any session, you'll notice the players who look like they're blowing, for want of a like non-physical word. If you notice that, it's how you can manipulate the session and make it tougher for them. So later on, we'll talk about like dropping random balls into a practice or throwing a ball in behind a fullback who might have had like been coasting for a minute, but actually you want them to do a larger run or get to the ball quickly. So you can manipulate for the players that you feel like aren't necessarily hitting it as clearly as others. But I think it's just your coach's eye to see who's working repetitively at a high level.
Yeah.
Also, there was a follow-up point, sorry, on that, that it's not the average of the team output. How we've analysed it is that it's the 75th percentile, so it's the hardest 25%. Which then means it's like that those real worst case scenarios, which I think is important to bear in mind, because if you did averages, that would probably bring it down much lower. And so if you went after those averages, you wouldn't be exposing players to the demand that happens in that worst case scenario.
Yeah.
Good Martin, just on that, obviously the picture you put up was for extensive data. Is that correlation the same for intensive as well, in terms of is there a sort of pattern that comes across that everyone's very similar?
Summary is yes. I've got a slide for that one as well, which I'll show you just to show that I'm not lying. But yeah, in essence, this similar output from positional differences. Similar kind of summary is that all positions need to be prepared for peak intensive demands, and you can kind of see that the bandwidth in 1 minute and 3 minute peak demands is pretty close by position. It's probably closer than the extensive, but that's likely because the number we're looking at is much smaller, because it's 6 to 7, 3 to 4.
Yeah.
Perfect. And I think just from a coach's perspective, and I'm sure you've had this, Martin and Lydia, I'm sure you've had this a million times, but we had a question around how do we ensure that the data and the numbers doesn't take over the tactical and technical elements. That I know we've probably all had players that have chased up, what GPS am I on, what am I hitting, where am I at, and get obsessed with trying to get the distance that they believe is what they should be hitting, but actually then lose focus on some of the real football stuff and lose focus on the technical and tactical outputs and what they're actually meant to be achieving within that training session. So how do you go about sort of balancing the two, really, both from a Martin, from a physical perspective, but then Lydia as a coach and managing that?
Do you want me to go first, Lids, or
yeah, go for yeah. it.
Thanks. I guess it's really worth pointing out that there's a difference between how I would think about a training session and a game, first and foremost, because one of my least favorite questions, and I might go on a bit of a soapbox rant about it, is that when a player comes up to me after a game and says, was my GPS good or bad? Because it's neither. And so my redirect is go and speak to the head coach and see, did you deliver technically, tactically what you were asked to do? Because the GPS is just a representation of what you did. Like, the amount of work that someone does is neither good or bad unless you did the role you were asked to do. Quite possibly, higher numbers may mean you're out of position and were exposed more frequently. So it may not be a good thing. When you're looking at a training session, then it's slightly different. And I think you have to bear in mind like what you were planning to achieve. So I think from our perspective, when we go into international camps, we think about what we're trying to get out from a technical and tactical perspective, and then how the peak game pace training can kind of magnify that learning, because you want to expose them to that demand in the situation where it's going to be tested most. So I think that's a key consideration about how we think about it. And I'm going to hand over to Liz now to carry on.
Yeah, so I think the coach's example of what Martin said at the start around GPS is, you know, we could have the quickest player on the pitch, but if she's offside every time she makes that run in behind, then it's not benefiting us from a tech perspective. Equally, you've got that kind of midfielder that's covering massive distances from a GPS perspective, but pressing the wrong player. So I think, you know, Martin's response is a good one to hear, really, when he gets asked that question, because it's got to be about what the game plan was and what they were asked to execute. But I think from a flip perspective, when we're talking about peak game pace training, what I would say is that that's probably the example where we do want the players to really understand the values that they're hitting and actually are they achieving the intensity that we require of them. And I think for me, that starts with them understanding why we're doing it. So every time we build that into any kind of training session on an England camp, the girls will know specifically which block within training we're going to be going after that, and what the rules and constraints might look like to help them achieve that, because you've got to get the buy-in from them to know that actually when I hit this 4-minute block, it's different to the others. The others might have been consolidation, might have been learning, but actually this one, we're really looking for that high kind of intensity and effort in terms of what they're doing. So I think them understanding the why is probably where I'd start with that. Them knowing when it's about to happen, so it's not just like by chance that we're going to hit that game pace, peak game pace training. They need to know that that's the block we're going after it. And then from a rule perspective, we found that if you repeat kind of the drill multiple times over the course of a season, hopefully you get to the point where they're worrying less about what the constraint or the rule is, and actually they can really focus on the intensity that we're trying to drive out of that 4 minutes. So it would kind of, for me, I don't think it would work as well if you changed how you delivered it every time, because they'd be constantly trying to think about the game and not the intensity, and at that point that's what they're supposed to be focusing on.
Yeah, perfect. And I think that's a really good point, because I think as coaches sometimes we always think that a new practice or something that's brand new or it's got new rules on or something that entertains the players is the next place to go, and we forget that sometimes it might take them a while to get into it and we might lose additionally something else. So yeah, that's a great point. And I think moving on to the next part of this was there were some good questions around area size, and I think this is probably something that we've all been constrained with at some point within our coaching careers, and if not so now, that sometimes the training size of the pitch we have might not necessarily reflect the distances that we need or the size of area that we would like to get some of the extensive work out. Or vice versa. So in terms of training pitch size, Martin, if we start with yourself, what would you suggest for coaches, especially those that have the sort of a half a pitch, quarter of a pitch at times, share the pitch with the goalkeepers, and maybe really restricted in the size of coaches?
Yeah, and I guess like coming back to just good session planning principles, need to define what the physical outcome that you want to get from it. Is it more intensive or extensive to start with? But I think the key thing to help and determine that and then how you're going to design that drill is the player pitch ratio. So if you went 11v11 and you wanted to get those extensive demands, if you looked at the ratio of the players per area of space on the pitch, you could start to think about, if I've only got half a pitch, how many players would I have in that similar sort of thing? And you can manipulate either the width or the length of the pitch accordingly to kind of try and make it work better. Even though you might do that, you may be struggling for enough area for the players to run into, in which case you can be creative with adding in additional runs around the perimeter of the pitch or to kind of an external point on a whistle. And there's all kinds of creative solutions that you could utilize in order to get that. Another one could be that you could just take a group out and utilize some linear running whilst the other two groups played. If it was a 6v6, for example, and you had 18 players, you could have two groups playing, one group running, and then alternate round in a round robin, and therefore you'd get that kind of extensive demand. I know Lids has run some examples previously that may kind of be more specific than some of the generic ones I just gave.
Yeah, so I think if you've got obviously the full pitch, the extensive is quite easy, and the intensive is easier on the smaller pitches. But I think, as highlighted, the challenge is when you're trying to get extensive in and you've only got that smaller area. So one example that I thought back to when the group I worked with were, I think, either under 16s or 15s. We were trying to get a bit of both. It's probably the first time we tried to go after some of the peak game pace training, and we set up in, it was just under half a pitch, I think. We did like two groups, and there was like a transition possession block going on in each extreme corner of that half of the pitch, where they were like 3v3 pressing, and then there was an outlet, and they sprint to the other side of the grid, 3v3 pressing. So they were getting quite a lot of intensive. But then every, I think it was about 45 seconds, the PPC blew a whistle and they had to sprint to the opposite grid on the other side of the pitch, and they would then complete in that block. But I mean, if you were really trying to hit the extremes, they probably hate you for it, but they could go round that pitch and back to their one if you really haven't got the distance to cover. So I think the way I look at the peak game pace training is that the best case scenario is that it falls into, you know, it really looks like the game, but sometimes if we've got the restrictions of pitch sizes, having to manipulate those kind of longer runs and making them do things like that, you know, is what might be necessary to get the outcome.
Yeah, and I think we've got to be quite comfortable with that as coaches, haven't we, around being conscious around when we might come away from the game and why we're doing that. And if it's to reach certain peaks or certain outputs from a physical perspective, then sometimes that might be the best thing to do. And I know, kind of falling into the bracket of the youth mods and other things that have come out throughout the recent years, that we think every player must be involved at every part, no lines, no standing still, everyone in every practice. And sometimes it just doesn't work like that. And sometimes they might have to be a separate group, or we might have to roll players in and out. And every session doesn't look perfect, and every session hasn't got every player in at every moment. And I think we've just got to be really comfortable with that and understand why it is we're doing it. And what returns it's going to bring as a result of that, but also what we might lose by doing that as well, and where I might make that up somewhere else. So yeah, it's a really good point. And I think it brings us on a little bit to the next question, which was around obviously playing an opposition with a level of competition. The outputs that you would expect physically would be higher than if I played a training game versus ourselves, a small-sided game versus ourselves. Obviously, the lower the standard in the question there, there could be more balls out of play, more bits of transition that you wouldn't necessarily get a flow of a game. So the question was around, how do you recommend maintaining peak game pace? Probably for those England players or the players that are striving in that group, and we're trying to push them and maintain those standards, while maybe the rest of the group or the level of opposition they're playing against in training might not necessarily represent what they play on a weekend. So, Liz, do you want to start us off with that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, so when we put peak game pace training into our sessions, like as I said earlier, like there'll be a specific block that the players will know that's where we're going to be going after it. And I think at that point, for that block of time, we know that we want nothing to basically stop the intensity hitting the area we want it to be. So examples of things like having balls really like evenly spread around the practice, so that if there's a breakdown, they can literally run out and get it quickly. It might be like 3 second throw-ins or kick-ins, so that again, they know that there's an emphasis of it's gone out, I've got to get it started. But often we might even just drop the ball in for them at a point, so that it almost like they're the second where they might be thinking, oh, how's it going to restart? There's a ball straight in from us. If we were doing 11v11 or extensive or something that was goal related, we'd get rid of set plays for that 4 minute block, just so, again, you know, there's nothing that's going to bring like a bigger delay to the practice. So I think it's everything you can do with your staff to make sure that the ball is moving for as much of that period of time as possible, would be my best bit of advice.
Yeah, how do you go about planning for that, Lids? Is that something that's planned for as an MDT prior? Does everyone know their roles and responsibilities within that 4 minute block?
Yeah, so we often have like pitch plans for training sessions, which will show like if we need like staff as servers or bounce players or just helping collect footballs, for example, they'll kind of know where we need them. So for that 4 minutes, pretty much, you know, you spread your staff around the outside of the area and they know what we're going after and where the ball needs to be returned to. I mean, we were really blessed last year. We had free coaching staff plus the PPC. So if we were playing any multi-ball games, it's almost like the free coach is moving around the pitch with balls ready to drop in and like giving each other like a bit of a wink as to, right, you're dropping it in next, just to try and catch the players off guard and get them keeping that intensity high. But yeah, you're utilising any staff you've got to try and keep the flow of it.
Yeah, and does that, I'm guessing that links a little bit as well into the first question we answered around area size and potentially manipulating some MDT staff to help support the players coming off the pitch. So working on some real individual stuff, so potentially a physio taking them out or the PPC themselves taking out three or four individual players and potentially doing some breaking strength work or something real specific on the sideline whilst some peak game pace stuff's going on and then people swap over. Does that happen quite regularly with you guys?
Yeah, I think it has to. I mean, our training camp numbers are generally 24. So unless you're in competition and you've only got a squad of 20, we're always balancing a few extra players. And if you're doing anything that's like 11v11 based and therefore, you know, you can't chuck the extra players into the session, it's about trying to give as much individual value to the players that are out at that given moment. So as you said earlier, like sometimes we've got to be comfortable with the fact that a session isn't perfect, but in my eyes, if we're, you know, we've got three or four players stood out because that's how the game works, it's trying to utilize the skills of the staff group to make sure that there's still something of real individual value to them. So the example I think like we gave earlier, you just mentioned breaking strength, like the 18s all got tested or profiled, sorry Martin, on day one of the camp last week, so by day two we know what their biggest area of weakness is right now. So if we're going to pull them out of any of the peak game pace training, got it eventually, then actually is there something that the PPC or the physio can be doing with them during that time that's going to really add value to them as an individual?
Yeah, perfect. And Martin, what does that look like for you in terms of from a physical perspective, where you're talking about potentially playing a lower level opposition, or when you're playing yourself you might not necessarily get that competitive edge and the higher outputs that you would expect on a game day, what's that look like for you?
It's interesting. So when we've analysed different age groups, the younger age groups achieve similar sort of peak game periods to the older age groups. And I think it links into this next level of analysis around game state. And I think if you look at it, kind of what happens to cause those peak game paces is when it breaks down more often, it causes more transitions. So from an extensive point of view, the more kind of transitions and the longer transitions that might occur more frequently in the younger kind of push that. And equally, the flip of that is that if they lose the ball, they're also going to press. So you may also get the intensive if that's a constraint of your kind of practice as well and a desired outcome. So from a kind of performance perspective, like there's not that much difference between 15s and seniors. But I think it's in what game state that occurs is probably what differentiates how you maybe train those different qualities in those different groups.
Yeah, so in terms of that then, probably the lower sort of the lower ability, or if we're talking about playing against each other and we're worried about trying to get that intensity, then actually the more turnovers that happen, the more errors that might occur could actually increase the outputs rather than lower it.
Especially if you go with some of the ideas that Lids mentioned around no set plays, balls going live. I mean, you can artificially stimulate that transition. So if the ball goes out, you can kick it far into a corner and a team has to turn, which makes it really hard. So there's little things you can do like that if you're worried that you're not achieving the peak game pace demand.
Perfect. And I think probably the question that everyone wants to answer and everyone wants the answer for, which we probably don't have a perfect answer to give. But what is the most effective practices? And I suppose if we talk about practices of rule of thumb or some real key principles when planning a practice rather than a practice itself, because obviously the practice is really specific to the individuals, the club, individual needs, what you're trying to get out of it, the game plan, strategies. There's a whole host of things as to how you would plan for that time. But in terms of just some key principles that might affect or increase the outputs for players, Lydia, is there any key bits talking about practice design that you would suggest as a rule of thumb you would ask people to consider to try and improve those outputs?
Yeah, I think, like you said at the start, I think it's important to note that we're not the finished article. You know, this is something we're working on every camp, and I've just seen like the data from the 18s camp. We don't necessarily hit it all the time, but I think we're experimenting with different types of setups to hopefully find the most effective ways. But the one thing I would say going into this season that has been like really good in conversations with the PPC is that you've got to start first with what is the technical tactical outcome that we're looking for in the training sessions. And I mean, I've got in October a 5-day camp with 6 sessions. So like my first part of the conversation with Matt isn't necessarily like when do I need to get this peak game pace training in? It's actually right, let's take session one. What's the outcome of session one? What is it we're looking to do in terms of tech tap with the players? And then almost trying to mold and fit into that, which part of it fits most beneficially, that's a word, with peak game pace training. So I think the examples that I would give is if you're going after anything extensive, then transition is your easiest way of getting it. But rather than adding transition into the session, if you had no intention of putting it in there, then it's maybe looking at what we did have in the training session and say we were going to play, I don't know, 11v11 for 12 minutes coached. Or can we add on a 3-minute block that we might do at the start, which still kind of goes with the outcome but has a bit of a transition emphasis to it that might get some of that out. And with the intensive, I think the example we'd use the most is anything around high pressure, where as long as they're covering a big enough distance, anything where they're pressing with intent is going to probably get that out. So I think for all of us it's quite easy to think of, you know, pressing or possession practices where there's going to be an element of transition and pressing all in one, so it's quite easy to get that out. I think it's a little bit harder sometimes to get the extensive out.
Yeah. How would you sell that then? How would you sell that then? So if you were, for example, playing a team that sits in a mid block or in a low block and likes to sit and allow you to come out, how would you then sell that to the players that you were going to do a little block of high press? Would you sell that as a what if? What if they do come out the blocks? Would you sell that as, no, we're going after some peak game pace here, therefore this is important, we do that? How would you frame that up for the players?
Yeah, so I think it depends. I mean, you're talking more there if we're going into a tournament and we've got to often do some of the peak game pace training the day before a game. So if we know we're playing, who's playing in a mid block, then it's quite easy to get extensive, because the what if is, well, actually, you know, they're in a deep backing against them, we're probably going to get turned around at some point. So you can almost get that transition state from an attack to defence perspective. And you know, in any kind of game plan, there's going to be an area of the pitch where there's a non-negotiable that we're going to need to press with some sort of intensity. So it's probably making it on that specific day relevant to that area of the pitch versus it being a high press if that's not what links to our game plan. So I think it's trying to manipulate it within what it is we're already going after. And the way I'm trying to look at it is, like, we often block things. So say we're doing, I don't know, 4 lots of 4 minutes of some sort of possession practice, then actually as a coach, I might need the first block for them to understand, learn, consolidate. By the second block, you might be adding a few challenges. But then by block 3 or 4, actually, you really want to see them do it at a really good intensity. So that's maybe where you then go after the peak game pace for that block, so that they've had a chance to get to used to the rules of the practice. And now they can actually execute it under a higher level of intensity where they know that you're expecting them to lift that.
Yeah, perfect. And how does that fit with you then, Martin, in terms of any rules of thumb around what players should be reaching, and how do we get practices to accommodate that?
I think it, just to reiterate Lyd's point, like, it's got to start from a technical tactical perspective. So the coach that I work with, that's my first question, is like, what do you need to get out of this session? Because if it doesn't, then it's kind of devaluing it. The point of the peak game pace is to expose players to the physical demands of the game and still be able to execute what they need to execute from a tech perspective. So I guess that's really important. And I think where our role comes in from a physical performance is to kind of help with manipulating that drill design in order to achieve the relevant physical demands. So if it's, I don't know, some kind of counter-attacking type transition drill, then it obviously needs to be more extensive based. So how can we manipulate the number of players relative to the pitch size, versus if it's more of a pressing drill, how can we manipulate that to make sure that we're getting that hard acceleration, deceleration demand that we need, and almost over-exaggerate it. I think that's probably how I think about it. When we think about the demands of the game, like, it's very much time dependent. So in the worst 1 minute, you may be looking up to about 200 meters in a minute, which would be two lengths of the pitch, versus in a worst 3 minutes, you might be looking at about 140, 150 meters per minute. So it's just looking at all those different demands across the different time frames and ensuring that we're covering all of those bases, because the worst thing would be is that we do a bunch of 4 or 5 minute drills where the demand is obviously lower than it is in the 1 minute, but then we get exposed to that really high peak 1 minute demand and we're not prepared for it. And that's maybe where you see a hamstring go, which then means that player's out of that game in probably the next 4 to 6 weeks. So I think it's making sure that we're completely preparing our players for the demand they're going to experience. And I always think about that worst demand. And that for me is the big challenge at the minute, is how can you get those drills up to that worst 1 minute demand, because it's quite easy to do it when the drill goes longer because the average comes down. But how can we really expose them to that worst 1 minute, which might be that 200 meters per minute or 8 or 9 accelerations, decelerations in a minute, which is actually pretty hard going, or some combination of the two.
Yeah, and would that be where we come back to Lydia's point around that, just that coaching eye and some real clear observation around just having that inner sense, really, of I'm not sure that that minute really reached the intensity we want. So do we add on then a little bit? So if we're talking about 2 pitch lengths, and I'm thinking as a coach, I feel like we've probably got one and a half-ish. Do we just add on half a pitch run on the end of that practice or drill? Is that something that you could do?
Yeah, I mean, we're fairly fortunate in that we have live GPS, so we can kind of look at every player performing it there and then. And so we can give some level of feedback in the moment, but our analysis system post session is also quite detailed, so we can always pick that up retrospectively. It becomes a little bit more challenging if you're just looking at it from a coaching eye perspective, but I guess that is one way of doing it, maybe alongside some kind of RPE type thing from the players, as long as you trust them.
Yeah, and I suppose that's where then having that catalogue of sessions that we spoke about and not being afraid to repeat them, of just knowing, especially if you only get post session results, of being able to have a look after that session and almost bank it into an area of, is it reaching the 1 minute, is it reaching the 2, the 3 minute, what percentages are we reaching, whereabouts should we bank this, in order to, if I need something like that again, to be able to pull it out of the book and say, actually this works and this is what it gives me.
Yeah.
Kelsey, sorry, I was thinking, you know, there was quite a lot of questions linked in the original questions to this sort of area. So please, everyone, don't be shy. If anyone's got anything they want to add or ask now, please put your hand up and we'll bring you into the conversation, because I think it's a fascinating insight. However, I'm sure you're probably thinking, how might this influence me within my own environment? So please do put your hand up and come into the conversation.
Yeah, perfect. Thanks, Mark.
Oh, sorry, can I jump in?
Yeah.
Just to link to what your question to Martin around, could you do like that extra run with them? I think, like, you know, like as I said earlier, in an ideal world, you want the football to be the main driver. But if, you know, there's a small period of time where we're going after that peak game pace training, then it's okay for that to look a little bit different. So the example I'd use is, on a match day, our non like playing players, or those that have played under a certain amount of time, tend to do a blowout. Is that the right word, Martin? Have I like just killed us for what it's called? We're gonna, yeah, you shrug. We're going to blowout after the game. And I know when we've done that, you know, it's quite easy to get the intensive part of that out because you might have six players and you can do 3v3s and really go after the Axel D cell. But it's harder to get the extensive, and you probably don't want them to cover massive distances playing like 3v3 in like a massive pitch, because you still want them fresh for the next game. So last season, Pete did just some like longer runs with them between the sets of the intensive pressing. So they almost do, I don't know, like a 3 minute block of possession, and they'd go out and do a couple of the longer pitch runs and they'd come back in. So you're manipulating it, but you're manipulating it for the right reason. You don't want to kind of kill them off because of the games, but I think it's okay to do that if that's what's going to help prepare them also for being ready for that hard moment in the next game they do play.
Yeah.
Yeah, perfect. And is there any constraints and stuff, Lids, that you've worked with or utilised throughout your sessions or throughout blowouts and things like that that you see to get better outputs from?
Yeah, I think, I mean, competition is probably the biggest driver for the girls. And if you can create some sort of like fun type forfeit, I mean, Martin just spoke about the under 18 singing. The reason they were singing is because they'd lost some of the peak game pace training moments on the camp, and they hadn't won that element of competition. So I think the moment you add any kind of competition, the players up their level of intensity. So whether that's like a scenario around like, you know, being 1-0 down, or whether, you know, it's just an outright, they know they're playing off to try and avoid some sort of forfeit. I think that brings it. From a transition perspective, it might be things like time constraints to be able to score. So you only got 5 seconds upon regain to have that shot. I think the older age groups in the PDP have used ones around link to transition. If there's a 5 second to score, well, you might see your wide players and your forwards shooting off to go and get that goal. But unless your back line's up to the halfway point, actually the goal's not going to count. So then from a whole team perspective, they're all covering the distance versus it being one or two players getting that explosive run. So I think they'd probably be, you know, the simplest of examples. It's just about how you can manipulate it to get that competition and get the players to really push themselves to that next level.
Yeah, and I think that's probably an important thing to think about around linking to Martin's earlier point about there's a very little variation between positions, although some practices might ask more of some players than others. So I think just being really conscious around, if we are getting that peak game pace, what does the practice look like? Who's it targeting? Who might be doing the most intensive or extensive? And how do I get the others to match that? Especially if we're going after that tech and tack output, it might be that we have to manipulate it with other positions or just be a little bit more creative with the constraints, just to make sure that everybody on the pitch gets that and not just some specifics that might reach the tech and tack outcomes.
I mean, from a observational perspective, it's mainly the centre-backs and the holding centre midfielders that don't get exposed when you play like some kind of peak game pace drill. And so like often I think about how can we either incorporate them into the game or make it challenging for them in a different way. Because usually their remit is to sit a little bit more than the other positions typically. So those ones are the ones that I find most challenging, I think.
Yeah, good point. And I think in terms of the next part and how we support that, I think from a coaching perspective, going back to, I suppose, what's being deemed as good coaching, if we like, and allowing players to play, allowing players a lot of time to discover, problem solve, unpick the challenge that's in front of them, and that's what's being presented by us as coaches. That sometimes, you know, we sit back and we allow players just to play. And that's been deemed as being a good way to coach. And I suppose now we're starting to think about what is coaching and how can we be more, defined of what it is that we're actually going after. So looking at coaching characteristics and how I need to be, coaching behaviours in particular, how can we start to manipulate those behaviours in training to try and drive some of this intensity? Lydia, how do you usually do that on camp? Because I'm guessing from your perspective that the norm is to normally allow players to make lots of decisions, kind of step back, allow players to discover the challenge you've set them, How does that change when you're trying to get peak game pace? Does it change or do you stay the same? What does that look like?
Yeah, it definitely does change. But just to pick up on, I guess, your point four, it made me smile when you were saying that the way the game's going is that, you know, we let them play and we probably kind of let them make their own mistakes and discover. Like, ironically for us, sometimes we're the flip opposite. We see such, we have the players for such a little amount of time that you kind of need to get quite a lot of information into them. So often we overcoach, if I'm being more critical of what we do, rather versus just let them play. But then when it comes to that moment when it's peak game pace training, actually, you know, the coaching side of stop, stand still, or you want to get this information across really isn't going to help us get the outcome that we want. So I think there's a clear difference. But I would say that the difference comes a lot more in terms of the manner that we have on the sideline and the intensity that we're driving. So it's probably motivational, it's encouraging, it's demanding, but it's basically you're changing your demeanour to get them to feel that actually they need to give more within that kind of part of the practice. And yeah, how you do that obviously is individual, but they'd see a marked difference from how vocal we are in terms of driving that in that part of training versus what they see in kind of the other more learning parts of the training session. And I think we all know with young players, like, they are quite influenced by how vocal we can be on sidelines. So I think the moment they see that or hear it, you can see the intensity drive anyway. So I think it's just trying to use that to help best keep that intensity. And particularly towards the end of the block too. So if we do like a 3 minute block of 11v11, well, the first minute might be like, you know, everything's hot potato and it's going really fast, but it's actually then being able to maintain that's quite important.
Yeah, and would you say that then your coach behaviours come quite infectious? Because I know we've probably seen the flip side, haven't we, where people will shout on the pitch at 100 miles an hour, calm down, calm down, calm down, and you're thinking it's having the absolute opposite effect. Do you think that it's quite infectious around how you say it, how quickly you say it, how often? Is it that you commentate stuff? Is it that you just praise positive actions? How do you go about doing some of that stuff?
Yeah, I think it's a mixture. Because as I said at the start, the girls will know exactly what part of training we're going to be going after this. And so it won't be a surprise to them that that will change. And I think it's very individual specific. So actually, like, we've done a lot of multi-ball with the under-17s last year, where, to go back to what you guys spoke about in terms of the centre-backs not getting the outcome, actually, you know, dropping the ball in behind and kind of giving the forward a bit of an indication it's going to go there before the centre-back, so the centre-back ends up chasing. So the forward probably doesn't need any encouragement if I put a ball in behind for it to go and score 1v1, but the centre-back might need a bit from me to go, come on, you can catch her, type thing, so that actually there's that motivation of I'm going to make that yard up. So I think it's very individual specific, and you'll all know your players and what works for them. But yeah, I think it's if they're not like recovering, then it's like a demanding more of them. If they're doing it, you just want them to get there quicker, then it's an encouragement. I think it's a bit of a mixture.
Yeah, okay, perfect. So it's, I suppose it's been brave from us as coaches, really.
I think getting the MDT involved as well. I know that when we all know that it's going peak game pace, is like, we all offer encouragement, but it comes back to what Lyd said earlier about competition and consequence. Those things really dial it up, and then the kind of motivational aspects of there in the moment are just another layer that add to that whole mix. So you set the right scenario with the right consequence, and you add in the right kind of motivational shouting, whatever you want to call it, then it drives that intensity to where it needs to be.
Yeah, perfect. And I think probably an overriding question that a lot of people have been thinking about in club, or whether people have written in and asked this question, is about the optimal time of when you actually do this. And I know it's going to look very different for you, Martin and Lyd, in terms of a camp, than what it might do for clubs week to week and day to day. But in terms of a bit of a rule of thumb, Martin, when would you say that this is the best time, or what they're expecting to hit throughout that week, that people can think about potentially chunking up and planning throughout the week?
Yeah, and I guess you can approach this in a number of different ways. Like, I guess the first thing is that in a game, we know we experience around 30 minutes at peak game pace, split across a variety of time epochs. So you might have 3 1-minute intervals and 2 3-minute intervals, etc. So key thing is varying that amount of work that you do across whatever period of time you decide is important. But then the next thing is, are we exposing our players to that demand frequently across time? And this could look different. So depending on how frequently you train, like if you only train 3 times a week, that's your only opportunity to expose. Them to peak game pace. So you might have to think creatively about how you incorporate that into each of those sessions, and then the amount of time between that and your match. Might also influence like when and how much you do. So for example, for us, we quite often will meet
Martin, I think we're losing you slightly just with your signal. Liz, do you want to just jump on and speak about your match day minus one, and then we'll get Martin in?
Minus two. That
can get him to stop talking.
Sometimes.
You can hear us.
Can we eject him?
Yeah.
Did you stop?
Yeah, you're in, Liz.
Okay. As Martin was saying, so we're at the moment, so there's the, what we're going after is 30 minutes. So basically 30 minutes is normally the max amount of time for a peak game pace that you'd experience on a match day. So take a 5-day camp that the under-16s have got coming up in October. We'll be looking to go after at least 30 minutes of peak game pace training within that camp. I don't even know if my video is working now. Can anyone still hear me?
Yeah,
I was talking. You can still hear me.
Yeah, Martin's still talking away. I'm going to kick him out the meeting and then he can come back in.
Okay, yeah, so sorry. So I was just saying, so we'll go after that half an hour. And basically, Martin used the example, we were talking about it earlier, that you could never do a one training session where you went after that half an hour in one block because you'd just kill the players in terms of it's the intensity of a game. But it's just how you manipulate the week to get that half an hour in over a period of multiple training sessions. So we might do like a 4-minute block on day one because they've profiled, they've done the MAS, so they've done some extensive already. You might go after intensive in that training session. But then like day two might be that we go after a bit of extensive, and it's trying to manipulate those blocks. Coming back to what I said earlier around what is it we're going after in training initially, and then trying to work out if we've got the tech-tac plan of what we're going after, which of those types of sessions lend themselves to trying to get the peak game pace out as part of that. So I think if I was putting myself in the shoes of some of you guys and you have the players maybe 3 times a week, half an hour might be too much to achieve, but as close to that as possible, you can try and look at, you know, where you could get a couple of 4-minute blocks in each training session to allow you to achieve that. But I think it's with the mindset of, you might already have been doing 4 lots of 3 minutes of a possession practice. So actually, can one of those 3 minutes be dedicated towards the peak game pace? But then later on in training, you might finish with a block of 11v11 for, let's say, 15 minutes. For the first 3 minutes, can you go after the peak game pace in that 11v11? Maybe do some multi-ball, as we spoke about, and then move on to the more coach side of it. So it's trying to blend it in with what it is. We often have used match day minus one as an opportunity to do some of the peak game pace. Normally it's, we've announced a starting 11. So before they go into a little bit of 11v11 to prepare them for the next day, the first 3 minutes will often then be peak game pace. And then we'll go into a little bit more of the kind of like final messages for the coached part ahead of the game. And when we spoke earlier about why we do that, I think Martin was going to jump in at this point. I don't think we have a real rationale as to it, but I think it was born out of the fact that Mo used the example that when she was a player, she wanted to feel some of that intensity the day before the game, and actually exposing them to that the day before may make them feel more ready. I was a little bit sceptical, if I'm honest, when we first started doing it, but actually the feedback from the players has been really positive. They like that it's short and sharp and they get a real kind of high blast day before a game because they really feel like they've got their intensity up and hopefully therefore feel more mentally prepared for the game the next day.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because I think everyone will have different views on that, whether they're tailoring the week of going, let's do some technical work on them maybe Tuesday and then we go more 11v11 on the Thursday. But the 11v11 then sometimes can have some more extensive, but ultimately might have a lower output than maybe the Tuesday because we're tailoring back down to then get towards the Sunday. Where actually you guys kind of are doing the opposite there, where actually you're hitting the real peak stuff just prior to game day to just really get that emphasis, probably get the legs going, the side corner and some other bits. So have you found that has any effect physically or is that just like a psychological effect for the players' lids?
I mean, probably the answer I'd give you about being an expert on the physical would be that I've seen no negative impact physically. There's never been a player that's pulled up as a result of doing that the day before. Ultimately, we always did 11v11 for a short period of time on that day because I think, you know, we might not have played that or trained that starting 11 together for large parts of the week. And then you want them to kind of like leave that session with that, you know, feeling of, right, we're prepared for this. So I don't think it's had a negative impact. And as I said, from conversations with the players where I was a bit concerned initially last year with the under-17s going into phase one, that actually they might feel like it's a bit too much. It was really positive in terms of their feedback around liking the kind of intensity that they got from that versus, you know, you could do 15 minutes and it could be pedestrian, for want of a better word. So if there's quite a lot of coach stuff on that match day minus one, just having that little bit of bite and intensity is probably a nice way of them feeling ready to go into the game.
Yeah. Perfect.
Back now.
Yeah, apologies. We kicked you out. We saw you talking away and none of us could hear you, so we thought it was best to get rid of you and then you might realise. So apologies.
It's all right. I guess Lids has answered the question, so I don't need to.
Unless you had a reason for why we do it on match day minus one, Martin.
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head with the mine and Mo's conversation several years ago. As to, that's what she liked to do, and then we just added I guess some kind of sports science S&C practical knowledge to it. So it's the balance between intensity and volume. You couldn't do a large amount of that work on match day minus one and it not have a negative consequence. So it's about keeping that volume in check, and so I know that when we do it now with Mo's group, we look at 2 minutes coach and then 2 to 3 minutes, depending on the group and their physical capability, of live play. And we do two or three different scenarios. So they accumulate somewhere between 6 and 9 minutes of peak game pace, but with good blocks of rest in between and exposing them to different parts of the demand. So one might be some kind of counter-attacking type thing. One might be how you defend in a certain situation. So we're varying that stimulus as well.
Charlotte, did any of that answer your question, or do you want to come in and ask your question that you just put in the chat?
Yeah, it might have answered, I'm not sure. It was just really, I know obviously you've put 30 minutes as like a ballpark figure to hit. So my question really was, like, is that sustainable to do each week, or would that differ across? So like, for example, if we worked across the player loading, working across 3 weeks, if we're on week one of player loading and it's a lower load, would that look different to week three? And then similarly, obviously on a training camp, I get, you know, your sessions obviously higher intensity, but then if you're on a fixture camp and you're playing 2 or 3 games in 5 or 6 days, let's say, would that affect how much match-based training you do across the week, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I'll go with the second question first because it's easier to answer because that's probably what we do more frequently. But yeah, it would certainly affect the amount of match-based training we do because most of those kind of phase one, phase two tournaments are 3 games in 8 days where you might travel match day minus two of the first game. Match day minus one is a little kind of exposure to that peak game pace that we kind of just talked about. And then the first match day plus one would be recovery. Maybe very light technical or any kind of tweaks to system that are going to occur, and then you may, if you got a match day minus one, repeat a very low volume of it, but you wouldn't be looking at masses because of the amount of work that you'd be doing in the games. I guess the exception to that would be the non-playing squad members. So if they don't accumulate a significant amount of work across those three games and there's no plan for them to, then they would be deconditioning in that period. So making sure that the blowout or top-up conditioning is appropriate for them in order to at least maintain what they've come into camp with. I guess from the domestic game, I don't know is my honest answer, because I've not really done it and I've not really thought about it. I've only worked in the international arena recently. I would hazard a guess that, like most things, there needs to be appropriately planned across time, and you have fluctuations in the amount that you do, and it will depend on what you've got coming up in terms of fixtures. So the more congested your fixture schedule, probably the less, well, you're just going to have less time available to expose them to peak game training or any training for that matter. And then from there, you can start to like kind of build that ebb and flow once you know where you need to perform. Does that kind of answer your question a little bit?
Yeah, thank you.
Can I jump in on that one, Martin? So, yeah, like obviously my experience last year with the 17 Charlotte was a lot of competition. So, and that's probably why the most common match, peak game pace training that we did was on that match day minus one, because when you've got the back-to-back games, you know, the day after the game, you're recovery and then you're back in and it's match day minus one. So I do think for you guys, you know, if you're in a situation with like, I mean, you last season you could have played on a Sunday and then played on a Wednesday. So the answer is it's probably completely unachievable. I still think potentially the day before your game, it worked quite well for us. You might be able to do that, but I think it would be about looking at how many training sessions you've got before the next kind of fixture and working out what feels appropriate. To be fair, the 30 minutes is coming for us this season. It wasn't a kind of like, I'm going to call it a rule, but I probably shouldn't call it a rule. It wasn't something we did last season. And last season, it was more a case of we went after like the little blocks of time as and when it was right to do it on the camp. So, you know, when the 17s went to US and we had 4 days, I think, before the first game, I think we probably would have only have done it on match day minus one and maybe a 3 minute block on match day minus three and match day minus two. But like, so in terms of accumulation, say we did, even if we'd have done 3 4-minute blocks across those 3 days, it's still only 12 minutes. So it's nowhere near half an hour. So I think you guys could probably do it, but maybe not hit the half an hour, but maybe just look to go after a 3 minute or a 4 minute block in the training sessions that you feel you can get more intensity out that aren't like a recovery type session. Because I personally don't think a 4 minute block is going to kill the players off in one 90 minute training session. But obviously, you've got to weigh up what you've got coming up next and what you've come off the back of.
So, Charlotte, just quickly, just to put it in context for everybody else on the call, just explain your role and where you are.
With Man United Women's Under 21s.
Yeah. So just for those of you that are on the call that are maybe in that WSLA Academy process, you can understand that the context of the Charlotte's question a little bit more.
Yeah. And I'm guessing that's why we're having this conversation as well around the peak game paces, because we want to prepare the players for these moments where they are going to play three games potentially in the week. And there'll be some tier three coaches, definitely tier two and one, that will have midweek games. And there'll become a period where it will be a Sunday, Wednesday, Sunday, that's a little bit out of the normal schedule from the Sunday to Sunday, or just like the WSL Academy work, or, you know, some will have the under-16s, will have county or schools, then they've got them. And so these are probably the moments that we're preparing these players for, that they, one, can survive, two, strive, but get through those games and hefty game periods, sometimes after Christmas where we get backlogs. And I'm guessing this is why, Martin, we'll probably need to do quite a lot of hefty work prior to getting to that part of the schedule to make sure that the players are ready to sustain that type of work.
Yeah, and a lot of it comes down to planning it out. The 30 minutes is a kind of rule of thumb. It's not a hard and fast rule. It's just that, I guess, as a frame of reference, is that's how much work occurs at peak game pace in a game. So we're preparing for the game, so we should probably think about that number. But like, like I said earlier, one of the key things is that the intensity differs depending on the peak game pace time. So in 1 minute, it goes like 200 meters per minute versus 3 minutes is 140 meters. There's 60 meter difference there. So within that, you've got a very hard situation versus a slightly easier situation. So you could plan in peak game pace, utilizing longer periods, which might be slightly easier than some really short, hard, high intensity work. And so you can vary it day to day so that you make sure you're not overloading players, but ultimately getting that kind of total amount of work in across time. So we've actually got a PhD student that's investigating the difference of like kind of a traditional training approach, admittedly in strength training. So two sessions a week, doing kind of a standard session versus the same amount of work done over more days. So say, for example, with Nordics, you might go three sets of three on two separate days. So that's 18 total reps. If you distributed that 18 total reps over 6 days, it's probably a lot easier to manage. So I think you can think about other training means as well in the kind of same sort of way. So if you split it up more frequently, you're more likely to tolerate and cope with it, particularly during congested fixture periods.
I'm looking at the time, and first of all, I'll throw it out there. Is there anyone else in terms of questions from the floor? Because I think it's been a fascinating insight into the way that the two of you work and an investment in time in this peak game pace training and everything. But it almost has gone full circle to where we started a couple of months ago, Martin, that the key element of this is that what we are trying to do is bridge the gap between the work that you're doing from our elite WSL Academy players to international, that they are able to play and work at a rate that gives that opportunity for us to go and win a World Cup, doesn't it? And this is the whole purpose of this across the whole game, that we can start raising standards and the ability of our players to really strive and move forward.
Yeah, 100% about surviving first and foremost the kind of demands of competition, which I think is probably international because of the density of the fixture schedule. So if a World Cup is six games in 20 something days, then that's probably the most dense fixture period. You layer in all the other things that we talked about in terms of the absolute outputs, so how much distance they cover in each of those games, how much high speed, et cetera, et cetera. You look at the peaks that occur in those games, it's a really big demand. So the players need to be prepared for that demand. And the benefit then would be that if they're prepared for that, then they're going to thrive in other situations and the game is just going to get better and better.
Yeah. Tommy, I know you've got a question. Just finish this section off with Martin. So for mine and Kelsey, and obviously Robbie and Amy, you're on this call probably because at some point we've impacted or we've been involved in you. This is certainly an area that we will continue to talk individually with people, and something that, you know, we're investing more time from our coach development point of view of how we support Martin and Lydia and the national teams to raise the standards and bridge these gaps. So it's something that we will try to continue to invest in. Tommy, do you want to unmute yourself and ask your question?
Hi, no, thanks very much for that. Really enjoyed it. I'm Tommy. I work with Charlotte with the under 21s at United. We were sort of asking the question between ourselves, like, what is an acceptable sort of percentage of peak game pace? What you might go after? I'd presume that you wouldn't be able to go after 100% all the time. Do you have like a threshold where we know we're in the vicinity of peak game pace, if you will?
Do you mean in a specific drill, mate?
Yeah, that'd be the one.
Yeah, so, I mean, our system's all automated. So when we do a three-minute drill, it compares it against the peak game pace for a three-minute drill. And then, yeah, like, it is fairly arbitrary in that you're either at game pace or not. So we don't have a percentage as such that is the kind of minimum cutoff. We just look at... There is a bit of common sense that goes with it, though. So if the threshold is 140 meters per minute and a player achieved 139, if we just use the system, they didn't achieve it, but you're like, you're 1 meter off per minute. So like arguably you did kind of meet that demand. So does that answer your question, Tommy?
Yeah, I suppose what I was after was like 85% or 90%, you know, something like that. But no, I think I understand it, and I've got a better understanding of what we're going after. So
I guess, like, if you don't achieve the level, then you didn't achieve the level. That's the outcome. And there isn't kind of a, you can't go 85% of that kind of peak game pace for 3 minutes or whatever time demand that you're looking at, because you just didn't achieve it. So, and that's what you're trying to go after.
Martin, am I right in saying on the webinar we did before, and we showed an example of some of the GPS data, and some of them either achieved peak game pace or they were just in conditioning. So there was like different levels in which they could achieve. So if they didn't reach the peak game pace, it didn't necessarily mean they weren't achieving something. We just haven't quite reached that for that specific player or that specific practice.
Yeah, we have four layers to our kind of GPS analysis. So the top level is conditioning, which is above game pace. So I think it's 10% above game pace. So if the demand was 100, the game pace demand was 100 meters per minute, if they achieved 110, that's essentially like overload conditioning. If they achieved 100, then it would be game pace. If it's below that, we kind of call it junk. So the reason we call it junk is more from a physiological perspective than a technical tactical perspective, because they probably would have got something from that end. But when you think about, if it's not achieving that kind of game pace or conditioning level, the player has experienced a fair amount of work but probably hasn't got the conditioning benefit that you want in terms of executing the technical tactical under those game-like situations. So we've kind of termed it junk. And then when it goes below a certain level, we kind of term it as learning, because it's not as fatiguing as the junk kind of category, but you can still do kind of like relatively low intensity work. So when I think about training, I try to polarize my training with the coach that I work with. So we try and do our kind of learning stuff in that low intensity zone, so it's not too fatiguing, but they're learning the basic kind of technical or tactical things that they're trying to learn for that session. And then when we take it live, we want to be in that game pace and above, so we're getting those conditioning and we're trying to minimize our time in that junk zone.
No, that's wicked. Thank you very much. Cheers.
No worries, mate.
Fascinating. And probably, I know, you know, we've had conversations, we could go on all night talking about some of this stuff. And we really appreciate, obviously, Martin and Lydia, your time and giving up and coming on to this. And obviously, Kelsey, we spent a lot of time thinking about this. And moving forward, again, for everyone that's on the call and everyone, please feel free to, you know, drop me or Kelsey an email. And I know Martin, Lydia, we can share some of those questions and we can come back via us to maybe answer some of the stuff if people don't want to go with it now. But last chance on the call before we sort of end, but really appreciate your time. Is there any sort of closing statements or anything you want to finish with, the two of you?
I guess like mine would be, we don't have all the answers. This is quite new to us. It's a project that started 3 years ago, and that start was how do we analyze the games in order to get this information. We're now in the last sort of 12 to 18 months starting to implement this information to try and gain a competitive advantage. So if you have a great idea about how this could be done better, then please share it.
Anything from you, Lydia, just to finish off?
No, I think I'd just go back to what I said from the start there around, you know, the coach's eye and you know, you're not going to have essentially all the resources and all the answers in the same way that we don't. And as I said before, we're still very much trial and error and putting on sessions and trying to see what outcomes we get out of it. But I think have a go, experiment and just see what you feel from the session as to, you know, how hard you feel the players are working and what type of distance you feel they're covering. And I think if you give it a good punt, then you're halfway there.
Kelsey, anything to wrap us up?
I think mine would just be brave and be conscious. Be brave to probably step outside the norm. Some of this will test to do that. Be conscious around why you do what you do and when you do it. And I suppose that real MDT work, I think this is just highlighted the importance of working with the people around you effectively, planned and again conscious around everybody's roles and responsibilities and what you're there to do. So yeah, I think be brave and be conscious around your decisions and conscious around your behaviours and why you're doing what you're doing.
Brilliant. Again, thank you everyone that's joined us. I really do hope it's been a benefit to you. I'm sure it has, because I've really enjoyed the conversations and the questions. So thank you all. And yeah, I'm sure, you know, we'll all see each other at some point in the future.